This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in March.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. 2 decades ago, naturalist and environmental writer Brooke Williams had a powerful dream about a dragonfly, a dream that cracked open his world by giving rise to a steady stream of dragonfly encounters in his waking life. His new book, Encountering Dragonfly, is his account of being drawn into a different kind of relationship with the natural world. By opening himself up to the personal and mythopoetic meanings of dragonfly, patiently courting an understanding of these creatures that it's built upon, but also transcends a naturalist's observation, Brooke Williams has come to believe in the importance of re-enchantment. Brooke Williams writes about evolution, consciousness, and his own adventures exploring both the inner and outer wilderness, and his books include Open Midnight, Where Wilderness and Ancestors Meet, and Mary Jane Wild, Two Walks and a Rant. He lives with the writer Terry Tempest Williams and two cats near Moab, where they watch the light and wait for rain. Brooke Williams, such a pleasure to welcome you back to the program. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. Such a pleasure to be with you. I always enjoy it.
So I think we met in person for the first time about last year.
Exactly. You were down here in Moab at the new USU facility, open house.
Yeah, so thanks for coming out to that. That was great. And the magic of Zoom here, I'm able to see a little bit of the view that you see every day out your large windows in Castle Valley.
I know. I never take it for granted. People laugh at us for all the pictures that we've taken of the same view, but we can't help it.
I want to start with Castle Valley. Reading the book answered a question I've always had. You and Terry moved to Castle Valley some 10 years ago or so, right? How did you discover Castle Valley? What drew you there?
Well, I'd seen it from the rim above. There's a great bicycle trail up on the rim. And a few years before I had been on that, I'd been to the edge of the rim, looked out, and saw this like community down there. And I'd heard about it. And Jack Campbell at the time was a really ardent environmentalist who I knew. I knew that he lived there, but that was the only thing I knew about it. We had a friend come into town for a few days. He was coming off a river trip, and after he caught a plane back to the East Coast where he lived, Terry and I had the afternoon to kill, so we took a drive, and we decided to just check out Castle Valley. So we drove into the valley. We just fell in love immediately, and as we were driving around, we found a little house that was for sale, and it was small enough that we figured that it might be something we could afford as a second home. So we called the realtor and were informed that the house had already sold, but she had a couple of others that she would like to show us. So we met her the next morning, and she showed us a house that was definitely not a second home. It was first home material. And we went in, looked around, and immediately both of us looked at each other and thought, how can we do this? So driving back to Salt Lake, where we were living at the time, we counted all the reasons that we couldn't just blow up our lives and sell everything and move to Castle Valley. And there weren't that many reasons. So we put our house up for sale, put an offer in on the house. And I forget what month that was, but by October, a few months later, we had purchased the house, and by January we'd moved in.
You write that always coming back to Castle Valley, driving in, it's like going through a veil from civilization to, I can't remember how you describe it, to I guess the natural world.
Yeah, to wildness. It just, yeah, something happens. The vibration goes down to where you can like function. There's very little traffic. Something definitely shifts right there when I turn off the Highway 128 into the valley. My blood pressure goes down, and everything seems calm, no matter what's going on in the world around me.
What is it about that? Do you think? And do you think everybody has? Probably not everybody has that, because not everybody is so tuned to the natural world.
Well, I think it's evolutionary, I think. I think it's how our species always lived until civilization happened, what, 10, 12,000 years ago, you know, with, you know, bustle and especially noise. I think quiet is probably the number one thing about Castle Valley that I love. Darkness at night being second. I really feel like our bodies are really tuned to that. And 99% of the world can't live like that these days, which I think may explain a lot of the problems that we have. No silence, no solitude, and no darkness. What do they say, that only 10% of the whole population of the world can see the Milky Way now because of light pollution? And when you think about our ancestors, every single night of their lives, that's what they saw, was this vast night sky. And you wonder what kind of knowledge that imbued in them. And for so many of us, it's missing now.
Now, some people, I'd imagine a native New Yorker would, you know, maybe have that same sense of calm when they come back to noise and an incessant light, you know. But you're saying evolutionarily, I guess we're more attuned to the dark and the silence.
I think so, don't you?
Yeah, probably so. And it can be uncomfortable, though, for me. I don't know, probably not for you, but sometimes when I go out into the wild and it gets so quiet, I'm forced to kind of, you know, do introspection, which sometimes can be uncomfortable.
I know what you mean. An old friend years ago brought his girlfriend to visit, and I wasn't here, but Terry was there, and they were going to stay overnight. And they're from New York. And the story goes that about 4 a.m, Terry heard all this rustling in the guest room. So she got up and they were packing. And the woman said, "I can't take it. It's too quiet. And I'm just really too nervous." And they packed up their car. They said goodbye. As they drove away, the woman looked back at Terry and said something like, "Aren't you worried that you'll be forgotten?" And Terry said, "No, I hope that happens."
Totally different perspectives, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I want to get to this dream, the seminal dream you had, and of course, talk about dragonflies and reenchantment themes in the book. But I want to talk about you pre-dragonfly dream. You write that... you say, "I've always loved the wild world. And from a distance, many who know me might believe that my passion for nature is another's for golf or the New England Patriots. For me, it's so much more." So tell me about that.
Yeah, I've always loved it. We grew up as children in, on the East Bench, where we had a giant field behind us. And I remember spending every summer, you know, 8 hours, 10 hours a day back in that field, just wandering around, building forts, chasing grasshoppers, you name it. And then one thing that happened to me was, instead of getting drafted, I found my way into the Army Reserves, which meant basic training in California. And I just remember something happened to me there where I was no longer surrounded by the mountains that I grew up with in Salt Lake City. And I vowed that once I got through with that, I would go visit those mountains. I would start wandering around those mountains. I would take advantage of them. And that led to the desert, and one thing that led to another. And before I knew it, I was changing my major in college from engineering to biology, mainly because I could get college credit for camping out. And it's always been just a deep passion with me. And the point I was making, where some people consider it a hobby, I think that's how it's viewed. Like, I really care about the birds I see, and in this case, dragonflies that I see, the animals. And, you know, when we have spare time, that's what we do. We don't go to Las Vegas or on a golf trip, we go to where the natural world is and try to see new things in new places. So I think that's the point I was trying to make there.
You've become an advocate, an activist. You say we save wilderness because it saves us. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, my theory there is that I think when we're out in the wilds, and especially for any length of time, we're living sort of a way that our species evolved to live. And I think we're touching deep into that place which Carl Jung referred to as the collective unconscious, which some people believe is the entire evolutionary history of our species, including everything that we ever needed to save ourselves. So my theory is that if we were able to spend more time where we're tapped into this sort of evolutionary cycle, and evolution is really all about adaptation to changing conditions, I think we'll be better prepared to do that. And not only better prepared, but also we'll be driven to react in such a way that we are making those adaptations that are necessary. That makes sense?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. So tell me about this dream. This is important. This is 2 decades ago, you say. It sounds life-changing for you.
Yeah, it definitely was. Terry's grandmother, Catherine, Mimi, we called her. So I knew her for about 15 years before she died. And she was really instrumental in getting me and also Terry to think seriously about this sort of unseen world that was accessed through dreams. And I'll never forget the first time we went on a vacation with her, with Mimi and her husband, Jack, Terry's grandfather. She would ask us in the morning when we were out having breakfast what we dreamed. And I started to realize that, I mean, I'd always had dreams, but to be asked what we were dreaming and then to have her say to us, well, if that were my dream, I might think of that, of this, that it meant. And she would attach these symbolic meanings to our dreams, to the symbols in our dreams. And so I always did that, but I never thought it was more than just sort of hobby. It was an interesting thing to do, and I wrote down some dreams, and I would ask her about them throughout her life. But it was always separate from my ordinary reality. But this dream that I had, I was during a conference in British Columbia. It was in a place called Cortez Island. There was a retreat center there, and it was exhausting. And one day we had a course that we were given a paper that we had to read by the afternoon, and then we were going to comment on it. So I went during lunch down to the edge of the island and leaned against this boulder, took out the paper and started to read it, and immediately fell asleep. And during that nap, I had a dream in which a dragonfly appeared, which when I woke up, I thought, well, that's interesting. I dreamed about a dragonfly, but that was about the extent of it. But then realizing that I may be late for the afternoon session, I hurried back up this trail toward the building where we were meeting, and immediately I started seeing swarms of dragonflies. There was a little stream running through the center, and periodically along the stream were these little bunches of cattails, and nearly every bunch of cattails had these swarming dragonflies around, these beautiful blue needle-like dragonflies. And it just occurred to me that something had shifted during that dream, that what was in my dream had suddenly bled out into ordinary reality. And my book is maybe, if I had to say, was about two things. One, my growing fascination with the creature itself, but two, me trying to figure out just what happened during that dream where my attention suddenly shifted.
It's interesting. We this happens in all our lives, probably. We don't notice things until we do, right? After your dream, it's interesting, you start noticing dragonflies. In fact, you said out loud, dragonfly. And your colleague said, well, they've been here all week, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And that was a shock to me. And then I looked back on it and I realized that in all my time outdoors, including, you know, going to college as a field biologist, I realized that I only had two memories of a dragonfly in all those years. And since the dream, I've had hundreds because my attention has been shifted. So there's something to that, and that's what I've tried to explore during the writing of this book.
Yeah. And then you also talk about re-enchantment. That's in the subtitle. Let's take a break now. We'll come back much more to talk about. The book is Encountering Dragonfly, subtitle Notes on the Practice of Re-enchantment. We're talking with writer Brooke Williams. We'll have more following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in March.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, pleased to be joined by the writer Brooke Williams. His latest book is Encountering Dragonfly, Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment. So tell me about this. Jimmy Notes, fascinating, fascinating person.
Really? And all right, so there's most of the chapters are encounters that I had with dragonflies. And one of them involves Jim, because he and I were with a group of people from the Grand Canyon Trust doing some day hikes around Bears Ears, the new Bears Ears National Monument. And our guide, Vaughn Haddenfelt from Bluff, took us in this place. I could not take you back there if my life depended on it. It was an intricate, very intricate canyon, you know, different little secret passages here and there. And we finally ended up in the bottom of this wash. And we go around this corner, and we're facing this ancient site that is so perfect that we all sort of just went silent. And the reason I went silent is that I was worried that somebody was living there, and I didn't want to disturb them. That's how real this place looked. And, you know, no one had been there for 500 years, lived there for 500 years. But it turns out there was a pictograph, a red dragonfly, on the wall on one end of it. So this ended up being one of my stories. I wanted to tell that story. And Jim was there, and I was so impressed by, he and I had known each other for a long time, but I was still so impressed by the way he approached these ancient dwellings and this landscape that it really rubbed off on me. So I wanted him to be part of my book. And I was doing some research, and one thing I came across was the interview that you did with him. I don't remember the date. It's been 5 or 6 years ago, probably. And in it, you ask him the question, what's so important about native knowledge, indigenous knowledge? And he used the metaphor. He said, imagine that all the knowledge in the world is contained in a giant library, and that, but that a major wing of that library is closed off, and that knowledge is indigenous knowledge, and we've completely shut ourselves off to it. Do you remember that conversation?
I do very well. Yes, he's a very thoughtful person. A great interview. Yes, I do.
Well, and that just led me to be going into this sort of imaginative space where I imagine going into that library, and it ends up being what I think is one of my favorite parts of the book. Because it really stopped me in my tracks. Because in a sense, what I realized possibly in my own imagination is that library doesn't have books and words. It just has, you know, feelings and experiences. And it turns out that it led me to thinking a lot about the fact that most of what we modern people rely on are words. But then there's something deeper than words. And if we don't have the words for something, we act as if it doesn't exist. But I think part of learning about what indigenous knowledge means to us is that we can't always put words on it. So we can't depend on that. But there's something so much deeper and so much more important. And that's what came through to me. And the interview you did with them really helped with that.
Well, I'm glad. I'm very glad. Yes. Well, remember that interview. You can find that at upr.org, by the way. Jimmy Note. So that can get us into talking about enchantment and re-enchantment. What's the link? You had this dream about dragonflies. You began noticing dragonflies. Of course, natural world part of that. One part of this that tickled me. You apparently have a 3-reason limit for a quota for traveling the 50 miles from Castle Valley to Moab. You broke that for this. You wanted to get a book on dragonflies.
Yeah, I called around and the bookstore back at Beyond, which is, you know, my local bookstore, which is sort of the center of my experience in town itself always. They had a field guide to dragonflies, so I had to have it. Because this is on getting home from the conference where I had the dream. Immediately when I got home, I started experiencing dragonflies. I found some in the yard, which I had never noticed before. And the thing that's really embarrassing is I found that I had like a refrigerator magnet with a dragonfly on it, and also like a plate that we use for art had a dragonfly on it. And I just thought something's going on here. So when I saw this particular dragonfly out in the yard two times in a row, I thought I have to know about it because that's my sense as a biologist. I had to learn more about it. So I called around, found out that Back and Beyond Books had the field guide, and I drove to town for one reason. Normally I would have to have taken the trash, picked up the mail, and gotten some groceries, but no, I just had to get that book and get back. But as far as reenchantment goes, again, I mentioned earlier that one of my best or my most important part of this book is the inquiry that I had about what happened to me during that dream. And this, you said, what is the link? And it may be a link, but it also may be a leap to what I'm about to say, but I still believe it's true. And this goes back to maybe a decade after the dream. I was constantly making notes about dragonflies that I saw. I had a file on my computer for the notes and what I was learning about dreams and the bigger world, the inner world. And Terry was working at Harvard, and we lived in a place called the Center for the Study of World Religions. And it was it's like an old motel. We call it God's Motel because it's part of the Harvard Divinity School. And there's apartments in it. We lived in one, and there were people from all over the world, from all different factions of religion, with spiritual disciplines living there too. And there was a meeting center downstairs. And every week there was a number of lectures in that building. And I went to one called The Myth of Disenchantment. And I wasn't really that interested in enchantment or disenchantment, but I always found that whatever lecture I went to was fascinating. And more often than not, it was about something that I knew nothing about and really didn't care about. This lecture was a writer who was talking about his book, and I write about it in my book because I realized that disenchantment and enchantment are not just feelings that we have. I mean, we all know what we feel when we hear the word enchantment. We know what it means. It's magic, it's wonder, it's awe, it's excitement. But it turns out it's a historical period where the theory was that with modernity, the earth, which had been disenchanted for our entire history, was now disenchanted with modernity. And for me, this mainly involved the commodification of nature. That the example I use is that we couldn't cut down entire forests of trees to build forts and temples and prisons if the trees had spirits. So we had to assume they didn't. And it's when it's along with the Enlightenment where we took sort of the position of authority over all beings as mainly white Euro people with European ancestry kind of took control of the planet. Well, the myth of disenchantment in the book, and it's a very academic book, but it's full of fascinating information. And in his take, the author's take was that the myth is that no, the earth is not disenchanted because we still go to church, we still believe in God, we still have spirits in our lives. And to me, it's much deeper than that. It's more of an animistic look at the world. And when I heard that lecture, I was making notes, and I thought, maybe that's what happened to me that day with that dream, is that my personal life became re-enchanted, where it was never actually disenchanted, but it was a shift in attention. And now, since then, my attention is so much broader and deeper. And the only way I can explain it is that my life has been re-enchanted.
Mm. Tell me more about enchantment. A key word here is magic, I guess.
Magic. Magic's been given a bad rap because magicians are all it's all tricks. They do very creative, interesting things to make magic happen. But for me, magic is much broader and related mainly to things that we can't explain, that no matter what, science has not been able to describe. And I call it magic. And there are things that science has been able to describe that I still call magic. Just because we can, like, explain something doesn't mean that it's not enchanted or amazing. And that's what I love about the natural world, is when you see, like, what comes to mind right now is I was out in our yard yesterday cleaning up some, you know, debris from winter winds, and I saw the remnants of our Datura plants that we never planted. They just come up on their own, but it's a beautiful plant in the nightshade family that's got this gigantic flower that furls and unfurls every day. And one of our great some of our great moments have been spent pulling chairs up at dusk and watching this plant twist open in order to attract its pollinator. And, you know, I think scientists know pretty much everything that needs to be known about that plant. But the fact that when you sit there and watch it, you get this sense that none of that matters, that there's just still this magic happening as you watch that amazing flower. And like I said, it can be 6 inches in diameter when it's all the way open. And when you watch that happen, something magic is going on that transcends everything we know about it.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit more about re-enchantment, how it manifests for you. You previously, I guess, you came to the natural world as a naturalist, you know, interested in biology, yeah. Interested in how things work, noticing things closely, more closely probably than most of us do. But there's an added dimension here, important dimension for you in enchantment.
Yeah. So a couple things. One is that I'm very aware of coincidence, but synchronicity. In other words, when two seemingly unrelated things happen, a lot of us call it coincidence. One example I'd like to use is a while ago, I was, maybe it was even on your program, I heard about a book I'd never heard of, for instance. And within a day, I saw that book on one of my friend's coffee tables. And I thought, oh my God, what a coincidence. But then I realized maybe it's not a coincidence. Maybe there's something that I'm supposed to know about that book if I hear about it twice. So the synchronistic idea is that there's no meaningless coincidences. They all mean something, and to pay close attention to those. That's one example, for instance. The other thing is that it goes back to the commodification of nature. We had to turn these natural objects, if say it was trees or springs or even carbon is in the category, that at one point was a subject. In other words, a subject is something with which we interact. And, you know, our ancestors would consider, you know, trees as subjects that we interacted with, as opposed to objects which we manipulate and use. So those are the two main things. There's no such thing as coincidence. Everything is a synchronistic event. And also natural phenomenon are subjects as opposed to objects. Those are the two main things. There's other examples of how my life has changed, but mainly those in those two respects.
Mm. The subtitle, title of the book, Encountering Dragonflies, subtitle, Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment. So practice, that word. Are there things that you do now, or do you suggest that others could do?
You know, one thing I think a lot about, Tom, is our attention. And it seems like lately with technology, especially our phones, we have this sort of passive attention. And the phone is like built to take advantage of that. I mean, my phone, if I don't turn it off, will like beep me when I get like a message. Or when somebody likes something that I posted on Facebook, I'll get a little like, it'll give it a little, me a little note and a little sound. So it can just grab my attention. And then, you know, when you start scrolling through things that the algorithm says we're interested in, it's like you have this passive attention that we just get used to being sort of drugged into all different areas, where active attention is where you're actually looking for something that, you know, I think of the primitive hunter. I think, who's the great writer about primitive hunting? Anyway, I'll think of his name in a second. But I think he said something to the effect of, a hunter only knows one thing, that he does not know what will happen next. So to be on alert for what is attracting your attention, in terms of out, especially out in nature, where everything has not only its biological qualities, but also its historic and cultural qualities, but also its archetypal and symbolic qualities. So something like that, which you're looking for, which you're almost hunting, because it has something for you and you need to interact with it, I think is a fascinating way to live. In fact, for 5 years, I took a break, but for 5 years, I taught a semester at Colby College back in Maine, and this was sort of the subject. The title of the course was Writing from the Evolutionary Body, but the stuff that we're talking about was sort of, we did exercises around enchantment and attention and finding the best story deep in our own unconscious. And a lot of the students would sort of roll their eyes back and wonder, is this stuff real? Should we believe this? This is nothing like we learn in the rest of our academic life. And I tell them, I say, you know, you can believe this or not. I mean, who knows if it's true, but I'll guarantee you one thing. If you start living this way, your life will be much more interesting. And they all agree with that. So I don't know. I think there's something to it.
Mm. You say that in many cultures, the dragonfly carries messages between the inner and outer world. And that I guess that started happening with you as well.
Yes, that's see, there's another thing. There, any culture that I've been able to discover has a lot of attributes which they place upon dragonflies, but most of them have in common that they do represent the messenger between worlds. And if that's the case, why isn't there something to it? And of course, the insect itself, the idea of an insect, with so many insects, you know, live in these different metamorphic stages. And the dragonfly, for instance, spends most of its complete life as a nymph under the water. Crawling around is this really bizarre-looking bug, and it's that way for in some species 4 years before it finally comes, walks, floats to the surface, swims to the edge, and then crawls up to the highest point, and an adult dragonfly breaks out of it. So it comes from the inner world. And it comes to the outer world. So there's messages there. So that's the metaphor.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, let's take another break, and then I want to have you tell me about the dragonfly itself. It's just fascinating. It lives 4 years underwater, and then it has this amazing transformation. I'll have you read a passage as well about transformation from the introduction as well. We're talking with the writer Brooke Williams. His latest book is Encountering Dragonfly, Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment. We'll have more with Brooke Williams following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast earlier this year in March.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have with us the writer Brooke Williams. His latest book is available. It's called Encountering Dragonfly, Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment. This last segment, Brooke Williams, I want to have you talk about the dragonfly itself. First of all, kind of an overview, the dragonflies and damselflies, I think. How many different species?
You know, this surprised me to learn there are like 450 species in America. I think like 5,000 worldwide. It's amazing how many there are. And I don't know who was at the root of figuring out which species was which, but a lot of them are very similar. And unlike birds, they're difficult to differentiate in many cases. But I think right now my life list of dragonfly species that I'm sure of that I've seen is like only like 23 different ones.
Yeah.
So and you I have a long way to go.
Yeah, you got to, but you go out and do try to find them, right?
Yeah.
I think we've all seen a dragonfly, but describe, I don't know if you can describe a typical dragonfly. There's an illustration on the book cover, if you get the book.
Yeah, the order Odonata is divided into two. The actual dragonfly, which is the one we're most familiar with, which when it's perched, its wings are out perpendicular to its body. The damselflies are usually smaller and their wings are more parallel along its abdomen. So we've seen those, and you know, you see a lot of those, and they're usually a bright blue color. Those were the first ones I saw that day after my dream, where these damselflies, a blue A, I think it was. I can't be sure. I'd have to go back, and I've vowed to go back and make sure I know exactly which ones they were. But no, those are the two main the differentiating features of each of them. So there's also a third one called the spread wings, which I think are more damselfly-ish than they are dragonfly-ish. But the deeper you get into it, the more fascinating it becomes. And then you have to start learning like the different pieces and parts of them. And that's where it really gets fascinating, that this creature is amazingly adept at flying. In fact, we associate dragonflies with these gigantic eyes, but there's a third eye in between them, which they call the ocelli, which allows the dragonfly to measure the horizon, to keep the horizon flat, and also differentiate between light and dark. And the most fascinating thing about this, Tom, is that the neurons that come out of this third eye, most of them go directly to the wings. They don't even go to the brain. They bypass the brain. And what that means is the signals that this eye is getting are translated directly to the wings. So the reason that a dragonfly is such a great flyer is that it doesn't have to think about what it's doing. It just responds. And as hunting predators, dragonflies are by far and away the most effective. 85% to 90% effective, compared to the nearest is like 35% to 40% effective. Mm. And they can fly in any direction, at any speed, backwards, forwards, up, down, backwards. And they don't chase their prey. They ambush it, which I think is phenomenal. And the downside is that the reason we know so much about this is the Department of Defense is trying to figure out how to use the technology that exists in a dragonfly and apply it to drones.
Yeah, because they move so quickly, change directions so fast.
And they go to where the prey is going to be as opposed to chasing it.
Ah, yes. Yeah,
that's a real amazing thing.
Right. Well, I wonder if you could read a passage from the introduction. You talk about observing. I think this is just near your home. Observing a particular dragonfly. To set this up, you say as a nymph, just days before, this particular dragonfly looked like a submerged plant part decaying on the stream bottom. And you told me just in this segment that could have been 4 years, I guess, bottom of the pond, right?
Yeah.
And now he's ready to transform. So you say he swims to the edge, crawls, and then finds the highest point he can find, right?
Yeah. What's interesting is that during that, whatever, depending on the species, is how it's different, how long they stay in the underwater, but they grow and they have to molt because they get too big for their case. So something happens where they break out of a case and they grow a new case around them. But at some point, they still feel that same growth, but instead of just laying there waiting to break out of their case underwater, they move to the edge of the pond and crawl out and find the highest thing, and then they just latch onto that. And then I'll start there. After hours of hanging motionless from a sedge as if dead, the meadowhawk nymph vibrated, then pulsed, and then its abdomen waved with new life. No longer able to withstand the growing pressure, his back split open, his still-forming body oozing through the slit. Bowing his back, he pulled from his neck, extracting his new dragonfly eyes from behind the shell-like protection of the nymph eyes. Bending more, he popped his head from its case and he stared skyward. Then two legs flicked free, rising as if in prayer, pawing the air. Then two more and two more. Next, wing nubs like tiny leaves came through the opening, stuck to his new sides. Like a yogi, he bent back, his abdomen slowly slipping wet from its casing. There he hung, upside down, faint, between worlds, angelic. An hour had passed when he lunged forward, grabbing his empty casing with his new legs as the tip of his abdomen flicked free. Perched on the casing, his wing nubs grew, inflating and unfolding as internal fluids flowed through the veins, networked throughout his wings. His abdomen lengthened, strengthened, and then firmed. His colors deepened, wings stiffened. Then he rested, complete. After 10 minutes, he tested his firm, dry wings, quivered, and flew.
Yeah, amazing. As biology, that's an amazing description. It put me in mind, though, and you probably had this in mind as well, that of your transformation, right? You had this dream and had a transformation, right?
I did, but thank you for like connecting those two things. And although I didn't like break out of some former hard shell, I did metaphorically because I definitely emerged a different being.
So we're coming to just a couple minutes left in the conversation. I want to take a look ahead and take this out to a very broad scale. You say scientists they think dragonflies go back maybe 3 million years. And I was just quoting you. Knowing this calms me. If dragonflies have achieved this level of evolutionary success, I can imagine our own. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, I just feel like we are involved in something evolutionary right now. I just feel like everything that's going on all around us, whether it be the current political situation, the way the weather is changing due to climate, the world instability, all of that suggests to me that we're on the verge of something great happening. And again, I don't believe that evolution is necessarily improvement, but it is adaptation to existing conditions and to changing conditions. And the dragonfly, having been around for 300 million years, has been through some major extinctions. They say that our life on Earth went through, we're in the sixth major extinction now. And there were like a number of others. One of them included the extinction of the dinosaurs. And humans have never been through any of them. I mean, we came close a couple of times. There's thoughts that we had two or three major population bottlenecks where our species maybe went from in the millions down to the thousands due to some who knows what climatic event or I don't know. But it gives me hope to know that there are creatures out there that have withstood everything that the wild world had to throw at them, and they're still here and they're still thriving in many places. So we can too.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess here at the end of the conversation, you'll be out today, maybe observing dragonflies.
Well, they aren't out yet. It's a little
They're not out yet.
Yeah. In fact, it's kind of weird. I don't really see them around here till like late June. Usually I've seen them in other places before that, but, it's fun to go to California and places where you can see them all year long.
Well, wonderful book. The book is Encountering Dragonfly, Notes on the Practice of Reenchantment. We've been talking with writer Brooke Williams. Brooke Williams, a pleasure as always. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Tom, it's always my pleasure. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks everyone for listening to Access Utah.
Hey, it's Skywatcher Leo T. In the morning, should the radio be on and you get out with a steaming mug of hot something or other, go out there and look at Venus. You can find it out there. It now forms a temporary dazzling second eye of the V-shaped Taurus face, complementing big orange Aldebaran. To see the entire V pattern, look about an hour and 15 minutes before the sun comes up. And out stargazing the other night, I watched the moon hanging near Scorpio as I picked out Antares and the very close double of Delta Scorpii in the telescope. It looks like one of the stars is around the other side of the other star after a few nights. Around the other side of the celestial globe, riding out the waves of the Milky Way, Altair in Aquila the Eagle shines at the east-southeast. It's forming the wonderful Cygnus, the summer swan with Vega and Deneb, or the summer triangle, always just above Altair, and a little left is slightly yellowish Tarazed. Altair looks so bright because it's one of our nearest neighbors, just 17 night years away. Tarazed, an orange giant star about 380 light years further out in the background, and below and slightly to the right is Deneb El Okab. The three form an interesting little straight line and are together Aquila the Eagle. Keep this in mind, we will visit Skylore of Aquila around the corner. And coming into the solar system at an incredible speed, it's a new celestial object, Comet 31 Atlas, just discovered on July 1st by the Deep Random Survey Remote Telescope in Chile, part of the NASA-funded Atlas Asteroid Terrestrial Impact Last Alert System telescope. Woo! Better keep funding NASA, people. When the comet was around 410 million miles away from the sun they spotted it, it was quickly confirmed to be an interstellar visitor due to its hyperbolic and highly eccentric orbit and has a highly unusual trajectory. 31 Atlas is only the third interstellar object detected visiting our solar system after Oumuamua in 2017 and 21 Borisov in 2019. Scientists estimate it could be up to 12 miles across, and we could also see it set a new speed record. Watch out, Roadrunner, zipping by the Earth with a relative velocity of around 135,000 miles per hour or faster, which is as fast as JPL's Parker Solar Probe. Not even. Parker's solar probe just went around the sun at 430,000 miles an hour. That's approaching warp speed. It's still too early to tell just what 31 Atlas actually is. Could it be a comet? Celestial object made of ice, dust, and small rock particulates? Or could it be an asteroid ejected from a distant star system to end up on our own? In any case, it's an exciting new discovery that could allow scientists to glean new insights into the nature of interstellar space and the alien worlds that populate it. Scientists still disagree about Oumuamua's exact origin almost 8 years after it was spotted by astronomers using a telescope in Hawaii. One less conventional explanation of Harvard astronomer Avi Lieb is to believe the 300 to 3,000 foot long object could be an alien mothership visiting the solar system from light years away. Who knows, Woodrow? I kind of like that one. As it is one sky of many cultures, let's check out the folk and sky lore of a before-mentioned Aquila the Eagle. Aquila is in a very rich mythical area of the sky bordering constellations such as Sagitta the Arrow and Delphinus the Dolphin. In Greek mythology, Aquila was the Aistos Dios, the Eagle of Zeus. That from under the night sky. This magnificent bird was responsible for holding Zeus's thunderbolts and occasionally running errands. Yeah, right. According to all our knowledge in NativeAmericanLanguages.org, eagles hold a sacred and powerful place in Native American mythology. Eagles figure prominently in the mythology of nearly every Native American tribe. In most Native cultures, eagles are considered medicine birds with impressive magical powers and play a major role in the religious ceremonies of many tribes. Among the Pueblo tribes, eagles are considered one of the six directional guardians associated with the upward direction, spirituality, and balance. The Zunis carve stone eagle fetishes for protection, ascribing to them both healing and hunting powers, and the eagle dance is one of the most important traditional dances held by the Hopi and other Pueblo tribes. In the mythology of some tribes, the eagle plays a leadership role as chief or top bird. In other legends, eagle serves as messenger between humans and the creator. The golden eagle, also known as the war eagle, is particularly associated with warriors and courage in battle, and it is the golden eagle feathers that were earned by plains men as war honors and worn in their feather headdresses. In some tribes, this practice continues to this day. In many South American tribes, eagles are associated with the afterlife. Among the Ashaninka of Peru, for example, eagles play the role of carrying deceased people's souls to the afterworld. Stay tuned, as next week we'll go in depth with what the Cherokee view of the eagle is and some more on that. Very interesting stuff. So keep looking up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.